you have about 18% of kids graduating with over $250,000 of debt only associated with vet school. So that doesn't even include undergraduate debt.
Welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today, we're going to talk about something not coronavirus related, because I think we could all probably use a break. Don't worry, we're going to have plenty of episodes about that. We'll probably do some bonus episodes outside of our usual Tuesday episode for people that are really interested in learning more about what's going on with the economy, student loans, and coronavirus. So check out those bonus episodes for that to the extent that we come out with them. But today I've got Diana Kerr joining me. Diana is a veterinarian at the USDA. Diana, welcome to the show.
Hi, Travis. Thank you for having me. I'm a big fan.
Thanks. Well, I mean, I'm a big fan of all of our listeners that care so much about student loans and rocking their finances that they want to listen to something like this, you know?
Awesome. Yeah.
So this is going to be a fun episode, especially for veterinarians, obviously, because we have a big group of veterinarians that listen to our podcast. But also, I think it's just really interesting in general to talk about some of the things we're going to talk about on today's show, like employer student loan repayment assistance and the stupidity around that.
Yeah.
Schools that just don't get it. And, you know, schools that don't get it because they're stupid versus borderline, like super shady. It's just going to be a fun episode. We're going to talk about a little bit of everything. So you sent me this really interesting report from the, I think it's the American Veterinary Medical Association.
Yep.
Showing vet school debt for the class, I think, of 2018. So share some of the things that you saw in that report that you thought were pretty interesting.
Yeah. So I know that on the AVMA's public facing website, I think the data is not always up to date. And I listened to one of your podcasts where you sort of said, you know, AVMA says this and this, and this data is only from 2016. And I thought, I'm going to send Travis the most recent information. Because every year AVMA does an analysis of indebtedness and employment of the graduating class. And they break it up where they look at domestic graduates and then they look at graduates of foreign veterinary schools. So just looking at the information about domestic graduates, every year the mean student loan burden that people accrued during vet school is going up almost without fail. But what I think is so interesting is that they may report that the mean is about $180,000 amongst those who took out loans to go through vet school. There's actually this really interesting stuff going on in the data where every year we're seeing that there's more and more graduates who are graduating without incurring any student loan debt during vet school. So, you know, in 2018, it was 17.3% were graduating with no debt that was associated with vet school. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have almost the exact same percentage. You have about 18% of kids graduating with over $250,000 of debt only associated with vet school. So that doesn't even include undergraduate debt.
Wow.
And so I think reporting these average numbers is really deceitful, because what we're seeing is this widening divide between people who either have rich family members that can pay for their education, or maybe second career professionals who are selling a house, you know, to go through vet school. I know people who have done that, versus people who are just taking out loans for everything because they love puppies.
I know. So I was just going to ask, so I feel like I've been failing our audience, Diana. How are people going to vet school for $0? And what do we need to do to get them that deal?
Marry a surgeon, I guess. Have a rich grandparent or family member, or, you know, I wish I had figured that out, but
yeah. Work for a lobbyist for the coronavirus relief bill or something, you know?
Do that first. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so wow. So $0. So 20% of people go to vet school now with zero debt just because they're rich, or yeah, they're from families that are rich.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, and I think it's fair to call that rich, because if you can pay 200 grand straight up cash flow in it, you're well off. You're better off than like probably like 95% of Americans.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. So there's definitely a component of vet school grads that are basically from a wealthy background, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, that are able to do that. Now, there's a lot of people too that are not necessarily from a wealthy background, but they're from a middle class or upper middle class background, and they get some help from family. One thing I noticed in this report that you sent me was that about half of vet school grads graduate with less than 160,000. So in other words, you know, about 30% of vet school people graduate, this is again 2018 data, graduated with at least $1 of student loan debt to 160,000. What do you think that tells us? Because I don't know any vet school where you can go and come out with $160,000 tuition plus living expenses over 4 years.
I don't know. I mean, vet schools don't offer scholarships in the way that law student, you know, law schools do. They offer little scholarships, like here's $500 from like the Chicken Fanciers Club. That's what I got in vet school. But I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe there's people whose parents help them out with living expenses, so they only have to take out money for tuition, or they have a spouse who's working and who can pay for the living expenses. I think that could be what's happening.
I think you're 100% right. So that's my guess. I mean, Based on a lot of the anecdotal evidence that we have from talking to thousands of veterinarians over the past several years, you have a lot of veterinarians that are having their rent covered during vet school because they're in relationships, right? And like the significant other's working. Or, you know, the family can help out, but they can't help out with like tuition, but they can cover living expenses, right? Mm-hmm. Or something like that. So that's interesting. So in other words, a lot of people are graduating with less debt because they're receiving financial assistance from family or friends. And that's kind of hiding the full amount of debt that they would have otherwise.
You know, and this data is only about, they do a survey where they say, how much did you owe at the beginning of vet school for educational debt? And how much did you owe when you graduated? So they subtract the one from the other, and that's how they get their numbers. But, you know, it totally ignores undergraduate debt, obviously.
Which is interesting, because also you have to factor in the fact that your undergraduate debt's probably growing and accumulating interest while you're enrolled in school,
like,
right?
Why don't we want a more holistic picture of what the debt burden is amongst veterinarians?
Yeah, because it would make it look even worse.
Yeah, because it would look so much worse.
Yeah, so that's an issue I definitely have with that data. Another kind of interesting thing is a lot of people go to Caribbean schools, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people will send me an email and they'll say, listen, I know it's not the best idea to go to like Ross vet school and come out with like $350,000, but it's my dream to be a vet and I really want to do it. And it's the only thing I've ever wanted to do. I mean, what do you say to somebody like that? Like, would you tell somebody to go out of state? Is Ross okay? Or what do you think?
Well, if you have rich grandparents who are going to pay for it, go for it, you know?
Yeah.
I personally am friends with a number of vets who went to those Caribbean schools, and they're awesome vets and they work so hard and their quality of education is great. But I have one friend who owes $577, and it's just like, what are you doing? You know? And so what I would say to those students is, have you ever had a job before? Have you ever earned a paycheck before? What was your paycheck and what were your living expenses? And then now let's calculate how much you're going to owe every month when you are working as a veterinarian and how much you can expect to make. And now add to that how much you want to save for retirement and how much daycare is going to cost if you have a child. Now, can you live on the remaining $10? If you can, then go for it.
So this is where I'll play devil's advocate. So actually, the people that used to go to the vet schools before they got direct loan access are in much worse shape, even though they owe much less, just because you actually have to pay it all back. So I've spoken with Ross vets that went back in like the 2000s and 2010s, and they were getting the weirdest, shadiest loans around. Like one of them was borrowing from like the associate dean or something like that. Like it was weird. It was super weird. And they actually had to pay it back. And it was, a lot of it was private loans. But when they got access to federal loans, you know, obviously these Caribbean schools are for profit. And so they jacked up the prices even more when they got access to the direct loans. So somebody with the $577K of debt, you simply have to pay usually around like 8% of your income is what it comes out to after deducting the poverty line. Mm-hmm. So you're looking at about an 8% hit to your income. And then on top of that, a Ross vet's probably going to have to do about probably 5 to 10% of their income into mutual funds to cover the future forgiveness tax liability. So a Ross veterinarian, at worst case scenario, is looking at about a 20% hit to their incomes, even with $577K of debt. So I agree with you. Like, you still need to take into account those things. But I think that with the current student loan rules, you actually don't need to worry that much about, can you survive financially and have a good life? You absolutely can. That's kind of the point of what we do. I think that do you want to have that debt? No. But I think that if your life goal is to be a veterinarian, taking a 20% hit is not the worst thing in the world.
I think if your life goal is to be a veterinarian, you should realize how bad mental health is amongst working veterinarians. There's so much depression. There's so much anxiety. There's so much suicide. And you should realize that it's great to be on that side when you're fighting to get something and you're striving for something and it's a challenge. You're like, I want this so bad. I want this so bad. But when you get out the other side and you get 10 years removed and you want to save for your children's college and you want to buy a house and you want to not, you know, you have these sort of very basic life expenses that you may not be able to meet. And it's just galling to be in that position financially. And I don't think, you know, and suddenly you don't care so much about this supposed job fulfillment. You're not happy waking up and going to work every morning. So I just think that I wish there was some way to give people a reality check that the job can be really great and really fulfilling. But if you can't feed your family, it doesn't matter how fulfilling your job is, you know?
So we're watching this thing on Netflix right now called Madam C.J. Walker.
Yeah.
Like the story of America's first Black female millionaire. And I'm just thinking about this because there's this scene in that where she wants to be like hair person. Like she wants to have this company that makes like hair products for Black women. And there's a big fight in the scene in the movie where her husband's yelling at her. And he's like, you know, if you don't go out and make money on this, then you got to go do something that puts food on the table. And I don't care what your passion is.
Yeah.
So that just made me think about that.
Yeah.
But it's true. You make great points. Like I think that when you're in your 20s or 30s, people tend to be more idealistic and more driven by passion. This is what I need to do. But then you have kids and you have the daycare bills and you have the college expenses and you have the mortgage. And then the people start getting a little bit more pragmatic and practical with kind of adjusting their life expectations. But I think that there's a way that if you know all the rules and all the loopholes, you don't have to be quite as stressed.
I think being smart about it is super important. And that's where somebody like yourself, I mean, I really think your website is like this oasis of accurate, trustworthy information in the miasma of the interwebs. So yes, I do think that there's a lot of things you can do to try to make it less of a bargain with the devil.
Yeah. So speaking of that, we had an interesting conversation with this person that visited our site who, I'll just say the place is Mizzou and LSU for vet school. And Mizzou would be out of state. And I had a way better feeling visiting their campus. And then LSU is going to be in state. And so somebody told me later that you can actually do in state for Mizzou, like after you establish residency. That's probably the case at a lot of these kind of schools. But the person that was recruiting her basically made a point that you're going to come out with a lot less debt than I modeled, because she asked what kind of debt could I come out with. And so you know that you can't look at the AVMA data from 2018 or, you know, even less 2016, the stuff that's public, right? Because you can't go back and borrow with that tuition cost. You can't do it. You have to go borrow with today's tuition cost. And so that report said that the debt rose in 1 year by like 9%. So if you factor in like the lag in reporting, you could talk about the average debt being probably 60 to 80% higher, depending on how lagged that class of 20, whatever number is, right? So I made that point. And then also you have to tack on the fact that all the people that are in this data, like we've talked about, are a lot of them are being reported that had financial assistance. And unless you're receiving financial assistance, you need to be looking at what, you know, the most indebted people are going to be in debt, not the people that are getting the financial assistance.
Because on Mizzou's website, they report their tuition is about 25 grand a year and their living expenses are projected at about 25 grand a year. So if you're relying on loans all the way through, you're going to have 200 grand. And I don't understand how it could be anything less than that.
Well, I mean, the person that was recruiting her, I think, mentioned on our site that, oh, well, I talked to a grad just recently that's graduating in this graduating class with only 100,000. And I think that the person probably meant well, because I think usually people that make these kind of mistakes are just bad at math. I do think that there's some bad actors out there, but I give people the benefit of the doubt and say, I think that most people, they're saying all these inaccurate things about what people's debts are going to be, are just really, really bad at math.
Yeah, I would say they were dumb. I would use the word dumb, but yes.
Well, yeah. I mean, so I responded to the person. I said, oh, are you going to be providing the financial support that's going to cause her to be in only $100,000 of debt? Or is the school giving her scholarships? Who's paying for that?
Yeah.
And, finally the person stopped arguing about it.
They should be like, here's a cardboard box she can sleep in the library, and she can eat air. And then she will only have to pay for tuition.
I think my exact words were, are you providing the rich father, or do we have to go find that somewhere else?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, I mean, I was, you know, or the rich mother or whatever, the rich parents. It makes total sense to me, though, because the people that work at these schools, they talk to people and they do hear average debt amounts. And like, if you're at these schools, like you don't think about what the debt you're putting the kids in, because that's kind of like thinking about how you're strangling the baby in the crib or something like that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a lot of willful willful ignorance. Yeah, yeah, for sure. Because they say, well, we might have a couple kids who graduate owing $300,000, but we're not going to look at what they have from undergrad. And we're not going to look at this. And, you know, that person chose to go do an internship that was unpaid somewhere. So they had additional expenses. You know, there's a lot of, well, we're just going to take the average. And I think it's criminal.
I actually have a lot of respect for schools that just tell you the truth, even if the truth is super ugly and awful. I just respect the heck out of those schools. There's some schools that just tell you, yeah, like this is going to cost a ton of money. You're not going to be able to pay it back probably. And you're going to need to use income-based repayment to be able to make the payments. And they disclose it and they tell people. And, you know, that's wonderful because at least you're telling people accurate information. At least you're saying, hey, you know what? The reason why we cost so much is because the government allows you to pay based on your income. And we're going to set the price pretty high because like people don't really have to actually feel the true cost. And it's a way that we can get funding for other projects at our university that we think are important, you know, and at least that's an intellectually honest discussion versus sort of the, oh, look how low our people's debts are.
I think what's being left out of that too is the fact that compared to other healthcare professions, veterinarians have such lower earning potential. You know, right. New England Journal of Medicine published a study in 2013, which I know is a while ago, but it looked at the debt to income ratio of the different professions in healthcare, and veterinarians had the highest debt to income ratio of anybody. You know, A lot of people don't know what you could make if you went to medical school. Like, come on, veterinarians, look at what a doctor actually makes and look at what you make. It's rough. I mean, you might love your job a lot, but it's not enough to make up for that.
I will say the debt to income ratios for chiropractors are about 2 times as bad as veterinarians.
Oh, well, that makes me feel better.
Well, yeah. I mean, we feel for everybody, regardless of what your debt to income ratio is. A lot of the dentists that suddenly got laid off overnight from this corona crisis, I mean, obviously their debt to income ratio right now is technically infinity because they don't have an income.
Yeah.
I mean, so we really do feel for everybody, regardless of what struggle you're going through. So you're a veterinarian for the USDA. What is that like?
So I work for, so USDA is, my understanding is that USDA is the largest employer of veterinarians in the U.S., although I think Banfield, one of the big corporate practices, is probably going to be encroaching on that title. USDA has sort of two major divisions that employ vets. One is the Food Safety Inspection Service, where I started out working, and the other is APHIS, which is the live animal side of things. I work for APHIS now.
What is APHIS?
It's the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, and I love it. For all the complaining that I do, this job is amazing. I learn new things every day. I work out of a home office. I make my own schedule. I get to impact a lot of animals' lives. It's totally awesome. I can't believe I am so lucky that I finally have a job that I'm really loving.
That's so awesome. I mean, that's wonderful to hear because of all those mental health issues in the profession that you've actually found something that you truly enjoy.
Yeah.
So what does the day in and day out look like? Like, what does a typical day look like for you?
I have a home office, and then I have a territory that is fairly expansive, and I have facilities within that territory that I visit to conduct inspections. So I'm inspecting them for their compliance with the regulations. I also do some education and outreach. So it's awesome. It's really fun.
What's the difference between that and the food safety side? Are you going and visiting like a rancher with a bunch of cows versus looking at the actual meat? Or like, I have no idea.
Yeah, similar. So APHIS does a lot of that food animal surveillance for diseases like tuberculosis and brucellosis and animal health stuff. I do more companion animal and laboratory animal inspections. But on the food safety side, many vets will work in a plant, so in a large processing or slaughter plant, supervising a team of inspectors. And that's what I did for 4 years when I first joined USDA. And it was a great education. I mean, lots of shenanigans in the plant, never a dull moment. You learn to work with lots of different types of people from lots of different backgrounds. But it is a pretty rigid schedule. Sometimes there's unscheduled overtime. And so it can be very trying as well.
Is that a traumatic thing for somebody that got, I mean, a lot of people get into vet med because they want to play with puppies, right? Or they love, you know, I mean, I'm being a little silly there, but you know what I mean, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the origins of veterinary medicine, the first veterinary school, which opened in France in the 1800s, was a school of meat hygiene. And it's because when you have problems that are affecting agricultural animals, it means you don't have enough protein and food to feed your human population. And so veterinarians in general come through their veterinary education with an appreciation for the food supply and for what a veterinarian's role is within that food supply. So I think, I mean, initially you kind of have to get used to the blood and the guts, but I think most veterinarians can be pretty professional about it.
Yeah. So that's good. So, I mean, you know, it's something that, you know, obviously it's not for everybody, but it's something that's not like this really sad, like Okja Netflix movie either, is it?
What Netflix movie?
Well, you know, that Okja thing where no. like it's this movie where it's like this super genetically modified pig. And the pig like escapes from the slaughterhouse. Oh man, it was pretty gut wrenching. I hope we don't get like hate mail over this, but I do eat meat.
Yeah, I do too.
And we respect everyone's personal choice on that. But that movie almost turned me into a vegetarian. It was pretty sad.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly makes you question a lot of your assumptions about the food supply and about agriculture, because you are really seeing it up close and personal, and you're seeing, I think it's a great education and everybody should do it, because it certainly helps you see through the BS that will be in a lot of sort of news studies and documentaries that are trying to sort of sway people one direction or the other on the food chain. I think it's highly educational to just go work in a plant for a couple of years.
I will say I'm grateful that I'm just a Microsoft Excel spreadsheet kind of a person, but we need all kinds of folks.
Yeah, so, for sure.
So there are a lot of opportunities in the not-for-profit and government world, it sounds like, for veterinarians that are interested in getting public service loan forgiveness. Is that correct?
Yeah, for sure. And what's so funny is USDA, the people who are high up don't seem to understand what PSLF is. I mean, I have tried to educate them. They read these news articles that like PSLF is a crap show, or is, you know, yeah, isn't going anywhere. And so what I think of it as, although as a GS-12 veterinarian for USDA, I'm not making as much money as potentially I could in private practice, especially if I was in a metropolitan area. I'm looking at having $200,000 of loans forgiven. That's $20,000 a year of loan forgiveness over 10 years. And so to me, that offsets the sort of lower salaries that veterinarians will typically make, especially when they first start out in the government.
Can we actually correct that too? It's more than 20,000.
Oh, sure.
Well, student loans are not forgiven, or they're not, sorry, tax deductible, right? So if you're getting 20,000 per year in loan forgiveness, you actually need to earn more like $30,000 to be able to take home 20,000.
Sure.
So that's one of the things that people often don't realize is like, actually, yeah, the loan forgiveness value is maybe even more. Now, that said, one kind of mistake sometimes people make is they don't compare the value of basically a 20-year type loan forgiveness program to the PSLF program. So usually when you compare those differences, especially if you have a high debt to income ratio, like a lot of vets do, the value might be a little less than that, but it's still a very large benefit. You know, what we'd like to show people in our consults is explaining why you can do anything that you want to do. So if you enjoy your job at the USDA, awesome. Let's optimize for PSLF. Let's get that full benefit, right? But if you were kind of miserable and you didn't enjoy it, there's also great financial ways that you don't have to do that either. So that's the exciting thing for us, is to find somebody who is miserable or super happy, but feels like it's, you know, they're not making enough money or something, and just kind of blowing up those myths.
Yeah. And so to sort of answer your original question, there are lots of opportunities in USDA. We're perpetually, you know, I think a lot of the vets in USDA are retirement eligible. And so we're trying to fill vacancies as people retire. We have sort of this like basic vacancy rate that we need to fill. And it's a struggle, you know, it's a struggle, especially because a lot of these plants are in far flung areas, more rural areas. I would encourage people to reach out, you know, and figure out if that's something they're interested in. I mean, call me, because there's so many ways that you could get a foot in the door, for sure. And
Diana Care on LinkedIn or something.
Sure.
Is that a good way to contact you?
For sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's a lot of programs out there for veterinarians that pay a fixed amount of money for your student loans. So one is the Veterinary Medicine Loan Repayment Program, which is for designated shortage areas. And there's also like some benefits that the USDA offers, but we were kind of talking a little bit about this earlier, and we've kind of seen that these resources don't really help PSLF borrowers that much. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So VMLRP is a program where you can get $25,000 a year for 3 years towards your vet student loans. If you're working in an area that has been identified as a shortage area, and there are different agencies that get to designate shortage areas, but it's hard because you really need to already be there and you need to be already working, and then they'll come and give you the money. It's not like you apply and then you move to that area. You need to already be in that area. And what's cool about that program though, is if you are in that area and you have an in, you can actually get that program renewed. So you could do it to get $25,000 a year for like 6 years, if you're lucky. And I know somebody who did that. But in terms of other types of student loan sort of things, as I said, a lot of people who are older, who are in the government, who are in vet schools even, don't know a lot about PSLF. And so a lot of programs get designed sort of ignoring PSLF and the impacts that things like signing bonuses or student loan repayment bonuses would have on PSLF. Let me give you an example. For a long time, USDA was offering, I think, $7,000 or $10,000 a year for 3 years towards your student loans in exchange for a service agreement. So they would write a check and send it to the Department of Education as one lump sum, and it would maybe count as one qualifying payment towards PSLF, and then it would get reported on your W-2 as income. So then the next year, your income-based repayments are going to be higher than they would have been if you had turned the money down. So,
And you have to pay income taxes.
Yeah. And, you know, and like worst case scenario, it messes up your loan servicer and they put you in a paid-ahead status and then, you know, nothing is working. So there's a lot of details related to PSLF that really sort of can negatively affect the different types of recruitment and retainment incentives that USDA tries to put forth.
So we see this with like all kinds of employers. It's not just the USDA. It's really tons of not-for-profit and government employers that are using their 1980s, like pay off your debt, you know, kind of redneck wisdom about debt, don't do it, you know, kind of attitude about things. And we've seen some hospital employers that were doing things where they would pay like $100,000 towards your loans in a very specific way that raised your taxes and your payment the following year and stuff. And so I said, all right, this is the only way that you're going to get their attention. Send the hospital president a letter that basically just says, I would rather take 20% of what you're offering me in loan forgiveness, because that's a better deal than what you're offering with my student loans, even though I have $400,000. In other words, hey, hospital, you're literally wasting $100,000 because you don't understand how to use this loan forgiveness program.
And there's also this like paternalistic sort of moral grandstanding of like, we're not going to give you cash because you don't know what to do with it. We're going to send money to your student loans. Whereas like these individuals right out of school might need a car, you know, might need other things, might just want to have cash in the bank as an emergency fund. And instead it's like, no, we are going to send it to the Department of Education, even though maybe you're in PSLF and all your loans are going to be eligible for forgiveness anyway.
Yeah. Well, I mean, can I just like grandstand for a little bit? Employers want people that are like afraid of risk, and they want people that are kind of down for that paternalism because they want you to work for them for 30 years. And so sometimes working for an organization you respect and admire and you agree with their values and goals is awesome. And that's the ideal, right? Like you've found that and that's a wonderful thing. But the overall arching goal is like, how do we get a workforce that stays with us a long time and doesn't agitate for things that they want, basically, right? And so the idea is, okay, if you do student loan repayment, then everybody's going to feel like they can't leave. They're going to feel like they're stuck, that they have to stay in that job, that they're not going to be mobile. And that psychology is something that they want to encourage. So like, that's why employers are paternalistic with that, is because you don't want employees switching other jobs and having to do turnover costs and having to pay higher salaries and things like that.
I mean, there's another program, and I hope I'm not like crapping all over USDA, but there was another program that they have, which is advertised all over their website, called the MLAC Scholarship Program, where they would recruit vet students and they would give them $15,000 per year of vet school in exchange for a service agreement after vet school. But they had to, you know, start at the most basic pay grade within USDA, and they were not eligible for any other types of signing bonuses or recruitment bonuses. And so basically, you know, when I was there, they were wanting to start new grads out at $62,000 a year, which is GS 11 step one. And this was an exchange for, you know, 45 to 60 grand of tuition assistance. Meanwhile, some of these grads had job offers in small animal practice making 120 grand a year. They could just turn around and give the money back. You know what I mean? Like that's yeah. like the magnitude of the help that they think they're giving is out of touch with the magnitude of the loans that people have when they graduate.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the good news is they're trying. I mean, I appreciate the effort, right? Like, it's kind of like if we were giving participation trophies for T-ball for these employer repayment programs, like we give them to everybody.
Yeah.
But like, if we were actually like, if this is a travel baseball league, like basically everybody would be cut. I mean, like, you know, yeah. even though they're 12 years old or whatever. I mean, like, it's definitely a little concerning. So I don't know if you followed this, but in a few years ago, there was this thing called the Fix the Debt Summit. And they held it at, I want to say it was Michigan State or something like that. And they had a lot of stakeholders. It was supposed to be this big deal showing that they cared. And just maybe talk a little bit about that for a second so our readers that don't know about it can understand what it was and what your opinions are about it.
So AVMA is the biggest professional organization of veterinarians. And I'm not a member because I can't afford it. It's $400 a year. But they, you know, put on these sort of problem solving summits. And they put together one called Fix the Debt. And I think they decided that they could fix the debt by like setting a goal that the debt to income ratio was going to go down and that they were going to offer financial planning for vet students. That's all I remember about it. And it's one of those things where it's like, this isn't helping anybody with anything because the people who are in charge and the people who are on the board of directors at AVMA have their hand in the cookie jar. They're all deans of vet schools and they have no incentive to lower tuition. And they think that because they graduated with $4,000 of debt and paid it off within the first 2 years, that everybody else should do the same thing. But it's just, there's a generational divide and I can't.
Now, this is the American Association of Veterinary Medical Colleges that put this on, right? This is the AVMA is the professional.
AVMA had to fix the debt. Maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe they did. I don't know.
Maybe they were working together. I don't.
It's interesting because like the suggestions were just again just totally out of touch. I feel like we need to have a podcast episode called like, "Okay, Boomer, tell me about your student loans," like yeah. you know, because that'd probably be a good one just because. Yeah, like all these people graduated so long ago, especially the people at the top of professions making these decisions.
Yeah.
That's the other thing too, is like you don't have like the 40 and 50 year olds making the decisions on these kind of things. Like you have really like the people that are, you know, probably 5 to 10 years away from retirement, right? People in their like mid-50s, mid-60s, that kind of range. And so, yeah, you go back 30, 40 years, yeah, you could go to vet school and maybe pay for it working part-time, or you could get, you know, a loan at low interest and just, it was like, almost free. Now the downside of that is you didn't have as diverse of a field. You had people from like lower socioeconomic backgrounds that could not access even those limited funds that they needed. And you know, you had probably, I would guess that the field was probably a lot more male and white than it is today.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. So certainly there are like good things that happened from having the loans be a little bit more easy access to credit, like in terms of access. But I think there's definitely ways that you can fix some of those diversity problems in fields without just like let's have $400,000 vet school degrees.
And there's not that much diversity in vet med anyway. So it went from being, you know, white men to white women. Like, to be honest, that's a lot of what it is, unless you're at one of the historically Black universities. And, you know, the Fix the Debt, like, it's asking the schools who are the problem to fix the problem. I mean, there's a conflict of interest. They can't fix the problem. The problem is tuition. problem.
Yeah. So I've had conversations with high up officials at vet schools that basically just admit that this is a backdoor way for them to finance research projects and capital projects for the university. And they don't have other sources of funds they can go to for this kind of thing because you're not getting grants from like the National Science Foundation or something for like a lot of the important vet school work that does happen and a lot of the research projects that they want to do.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's unlimited. I mean, my understanding is that schools can set their target, their loan level at whatever level they want. So they can raise tuition as high as they want. And you're always going to be able to get federal student loans for that, which I think is really a broken system. But yeah, I mean, the tuition is ridiculous. It's gone up 200% since the year 2000, I think.
Yeah, probably more than that. I mean, so it's a broken system, but it's basically just like, they're like, well, we didn't make the system. We're just going to take advantage of it to do the things that we think are important. that's kind of the problem that we have.
And so we did. So one thing that was really eye-opening for me, I'm involved with the National Association of Federal Veterinarians. And again, I'm not here speaking in an official capacity, but I was very passionate about PSLF when I first joined USDA. And I was talking to all these other vets who were at different stages of their career. And there were so many questions and so much misinformation about PSLF that I said, can we do a survey to all of our members, veterinarians throughout the government, to see what the student loan burden is? And I'm not aware if a survey like this has been done in the veterinary community at large. So we sent out a survey and it was like, how old are you? What year did you graduate? You know, how many loans did you have? How much did you owe when you graduated? How much do you owe now? So we could see if people were, you know, in negative amortization on their loans. And it was shocking. Like, there were people in their 50s who still owe on their student loans. There were people, the student loan burden was so much greater than I had expected. And I think in our youngest cohort, which is people who were 25 to 35 years old, 100% of them had student loans. 75% of them were upside down on their student loans. 95% of them were looking at PSLF as their only option to pay back their student loans. I mean, it was mind-boggling. And so I think if you are going to try to design initiatives to solve in quotes, the veterinary student loan problem, you need to have people from all different stages of their career represented. Because I think you're right. When you go to these initiatives, you have people who are the deans of vet schools who are 2 years away from retiring and are making a lot of money. And they don't understand that between the time you graduate and the time you retire, there's all this other stuff happening. And your loans, in many cases, are growing rather than shrinking.
So, real question, right? Let's say that you have a friend who's a freshman in college and she wants to be a veterinarian. Pretend that you can't rely on the PSLF program, but maybe you can rely on like income-based repayment or something like that. What would you tell her about becoming a vet? What would be your suggestions?
I think it's really tough. I would be tempted to tell her not to do it, to be totally honest. She could be a vet tech or something else and have very few student loans and still get to be in the veterinary medical community. This is assuming she doesn't have rich grandparents who are willing to pay for everything. But, you know, I would just sit down and run numbers and be like, if this is what you take out for school, this is what your payments are going to be, and this is what your projected income might be at that time, and these are the other expenses you're going to have. Because I think someone who's making $150,000 or $200,000 a year, if they have 5% of their income left over for miscellaneous expenses at the end of the month, that's a significant amount of money. But if you only make $65,000 a year and you've got 5% left over at the end of the month, that's not enough to cover emergency expenses. And so I just think that the reality of the financial stuff is hard. I mean, I have a friend who owes over $350,000 of loans. She's divorced. She's taking care of a kid by herself. She's working two jobs. And it's just devastating financially for her, you know, to have to pay for a nanny to take care of your kid after school until after they go to bed because you're working 15 hours a day is ridiculous. So I would have very frank conversations with my friend.
So the only thing I would say is like, I would disagree a little bit because the worst case scenario, again, is 20% of your income is going to get lost to your student loans. So the problem in that situation is not that she's a veterinarian working the 15-hour days or whatever. The problem is that she has so many expenses that might be unavoidable, like obviously childcare and things like that. You might not be able to get out of that expense. But I would say at least that expense theoretically is temporary. Like she's not going to have a nanny for forever.
Yeah, it's true.
It's kind of like if you can do something that you enjoy and survive and get your loans on the right plan and have a decent savings rate, put something into retirement, even if it's the wrong funds, but start an account for investing outside of retirement somewhere, even if it's like the wrong place. That's so important. I just think that, you know, people always can have the options in life. So I think that that's the good news. So if you're comfortable sharing, what is your loan strategy? Like what payment plan are you on? Like maybe give us a range of debt that you might have.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't care. I graduated owing I graduated in 2011 from Oregon State University. I owed $150,000 when I graduated, but I had gone overseas for the first year of school. And so my tuition wasn't reflective of what my classmates might have been. It was higher than them probably. I've been working basically constantly since then with a few small breaks, including like an unpaid maternity leave. And so now I owe 196 because I was on IBR, which was the old IBR, which was 15% of your income for a long time. And now I'm on Repay because I have a household size of 3 and I'm the only income earner. So Repay was better for me. So my payments, I think, are $473 a month. And I am shooting towards PSLF. I have 4 years left.
And what state do you live in?
Mississippi.
Okay. So yeah, so if you were in a community property state, you could file taxes separately and IBR would actually be cheaper than Repay.
Oh.
Yeah, but because you can pay based on half of your household's income instead of all of it. So 15% of half of your income instead of all of it, if you live in a state like California.
If your spouse is not earning income, would that be?
Correct. Yeah.
So you would do half of your income, like half of your income goes to them?
In a community property state, when you file taxes separately, you evenly distribute income across both spouses' returns. And so that makes some unique planning opportunities because it basically makes the tax penalty nothing to file separately when it would be substantial if you're in a place like with normal community property rules. But in Mississippi, it has the normal rules. So you're on the right plan for Mississippi, but it just shows you how complicated things can really be.
Yeah, for sure. Especially when you throw marriage in it. Yeah.
Well, like if you were in Mississippi and say you were married to somebody that was making a lot more than you, it actually might make sense to file taxes separately and do IBR, you know, because you're not eligible for pay as you earn because of when you went to school. So, you know, it really is a pretty complicated thing.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
So any other things you want to share about for folks that are dealing with student loans, like encouraging words, suggestions for what kind of jobs, if they want to reach out, like just whatever you think you want to, you know, leave our listeners with?
Well, I think it pays to do your research. I think Travis is a great tool you can use to help get your student loan situation figured out, honestly. I mean, I just can't emphasize how much you have to take responsibility and read all the paperwork and read all the fine print and make sure that what you're doing is right for you as best as you can figure. Because I interface with a lot of people who are just entering the federal service and they've got all these questions about PSLF. And I send them to your website, Travis, because you've got the best articles and podcasts that sort of debunk a lot of the nonsense that's out there about PSLF right now. And I think that for veterinarians who might be on the fence and might be thinking about federal service, I think this is something that they should consider to be a big incentive for federal service, because there are not that many ways that vets can qualify for PSLF. Basically, it's this or work at a nonprofit.
Plus, it's a lot easier to social distance and have some lot of animals and pets and horses and stuff in Mississippi than it is in New York City, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Or Washington, D.C.
Yes.
You know, maybe too soon, you know, but like this coronavirus outbreak, I mean, trust me, I'm kind of wishing we weren't in a 1,000-square-foot apartment right now. I mean, it would be nice to have some more space.
Yeah, it's easy to social distance here. That's for sure. We have space between individuals. There's not any sort of large metropolitan areas that are here. But, you know, Memphis is only about 100 miles north of me, and they are sort of a cesspool. So,
yeah. Well, on that note, you know, Diana Kerr on LinkedIn, if y'all want to reach out to her. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Travis, thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to today's show. You can email us your comments at podcast@studentloanplanner.com. You can also find show notes at studentloanplanner.com/ the number of today's episode. If you know that you need a custom student loan plan, schedule one today with one of our team members at studentloanplanner.com/book. Or if you want to learn more, visit /help. If you like the podcast, please share it with someone who owes more student loan debt than you do. Keep calm and build wealth, and have a great week.